You have published, at least 7 papers out of that work at Illinois, mostly dealing with pyrolysis and things
related. Well, I was on ketenes there too, yes. I think.
Because you really developed the best way of making ketene compared to what had been in the literature up to that point.
Well, it was an 11% yield according to the work of Schmidl and Bergman. After a half year, I was able to get that up to about 17 or 18% by heating it to 700 instead of 650. Mm. But heating it that hot was not conventional those days. That is, in other words, a combustion furnace will hardly do it. So I got some help in the chemical engineering department about making a tube that was not for analytical purposes, but just for passing things through it that are pretty hot. And that worked. That was the way that we actually there got it up to about 17. But then one of my students decided to have a ketene lamp, and that put it up to about 90% yield of the part that decomposed. And we had a chromel wire that was heated to glowing, and then in underneath was simply a bucket of acetone that was boiling, and the vapors passed up through that on the way out, and then you'd pass the ketene into what you wanted it to work with. And that is the only way to make ketene, I think, yet, because it gives a good yield.
Mm-hmm. Did you do much work with diketene also?
Yeah.
I remember when I sent in a paper to Marshall Gates showing that diketene forms an adduct with acetone.
Right.
He wrote back to me and he said, well, you probably saw the correspondence in 52, saying it's hard to believe because after all the work of Hurd and the work of Union Carbide, if it really did form an adduct with acetone, they would know about it.
Well, we didn't. But you did.
Well, bit of luck. And in all those years, of course, there was a doubt where the double bond was.
Mm-hmm.
First poem sold by NMR, Herb Gutowski.
Well, you see, here's an old ketene man, too. Perhaps you're an acetone man.
You mentioned the graduate students that you had at Illinois, and I wanted to ask you how, I counted at least 5, and you were there only 3 years. I wanted to ask you how it was attracting graduate students, given that Adams and Marvel were there, how in 3 years you had 5 graduate students.
Not necessarily. I had perhaps that many that worked with me, but most of them were seniors.
I see. Okay.
In other words, my first one was Paul Cochran,
mm-hmm.
and I've kept in touch with him ever since Christmas Cards Yet.
Really?
No, he actually is the one that got the ketene thing moving. And then I had a person that lives in Cicero here yet. Oh, God, I know his name. Kokor.
Mm-hmm.
He heads up the Kokor Chemical Company. And then I had a person that was a senior, but he became a graduate student. He actually transferred up here with me.
At that point, Illinois was the best school in the country.
Well, it certainly was a big one and a good one. Yeah. Northwestern was quite young. That is, in other words, this institution is old, going to the 1850s, but the chemistry department began in 1920 with W. Lee Lewis, who was part of the Army, I think, that is, he was here as an associate professor when World War I came on, and he was transferred to the Army at the Catholic University of America. And the problem that he had that was assigned to him, he was also in offense research by L.W. Jones, was prepare some new vesicant that has arsenic in the molecule. That'll probably make it more poisonous. He wasn't getting anywhere at all. And he was talking about it to the Catholic priest one day that taught chemistry at the Catholic University. And he said, you know, I remember about 6 or 8 years ago, we had a boy here that was earning his PhD by studying acetylene. And one of the things he passed it into was arsenic trichloride, and he got the most god-awful mess that he decided not to do anything at all to purify it, just to write up as a page in his dissertation and go about doing some more pleasant things. Well, that was just what Lewis, sir, wanted to know. So that afternoon he got a tank of acetylene and passed it in through arsenic trichloride. Nothing happened. Just bubbled in and bubbled out. He went back to the priest and told him that. Oh, yes, I remember. He also had some anhydrous aluminum chloride there. And thus was the birth of Lewisite. That person with acetylene was Father Newland.
Oh, yes. Yes.
He earned his PhD there, and then he went to Notre Dame with all the rest of his life on acetylene.
Mm-hmm.
A charming man, too. Did you ever know him?
No.
Well, he was really, I think, one of the best. You probably knew him, didn't you?
Well, I heard him. He didn't know me. I knew him.
Yeah.
Did you have interactions with him?
With Newland? Well, only as an organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
That is, he was at Notre Dame and I was here, and he had me down once to give a chemical talk.
When you went to Illinois, what was your position? Were you an assistant professor?
I was an instructor.
Yeah.
And I stayed that all 3 years I was there, and I got moved up here to be an assistant professor. If I had stayed there, Marvel told me that I'd be promoted probably to an associate. They had that rank there. I don't know if they do yet. It's a rank we don't have, in between instructor and assistant professor.
How did that move up here come about?
Well, by hiring a van.
No, I meant...
How did they twist you out?
Keeping me on my toes here. Were you looking for someplace else? Were you looking to get out of Illinois?
No. As a matter of fact, I even was thinking about not accepting it. But what had happened was, at the University of Minnesota, L.W. Jones had brought up Frank Whitmore for his teaching there at Rice Institute. He had earned a PhD at Harvard, and then he went to Rice for a year, and Jones got him the next year as an assistant professor. And transferred here at the request of W. Lee Lewis when the previous head of the department here, a guy named Young that had never done anything, he resigned and died about 2 years later. So he had to have a replacement for Professor Young. He did never have a doctorate degree. He sort of there shopped around at three or four colleges in Europe, but never actually stayed anywhere to get a degree. But that made the opening for having Whitmore here. Well, Lewis and Whitmore both had grants from the American Petroleum Institute, and pardon me, that is not right. Let's get this straight now. I think they applied to the Public Health Institute at Washington to get funds with which to do some work on arsenic as a medicinal, because he had recalled that Ehrlich, 10 years earlier, had published on selvarsan, arsphenamine 606, as the best drug there for their curing gonorrhea, syphilis, and they were able to get that. Whitmore even asked for it because of his work on mercury, and Lewis asked for it because of his work there on lewisite, and that put some cash in the hands of the department with which they could attract some graduate students. That's the way they got it. Well, in 1924, Lewis decided that he would resign to become the director of the Institute of American Meat Packers down at the stockyards, and that left an opening. But you see, Whitmore had known me at Minnesota, because he was there at the same time I was there as a graduate student, and probably that's the reason that he went down to Illinois and see if I could come up here for a vacancy to take the place of Lewis, not the title, just to teach organic. He taught freshman chemistry in the main.
Well, but the decision must have been difficult because Illinois was such a superb school. Northwestern is a very good school today, but it wasn't that.
It wasn't then, that's right. Now, what they had here in organic, Lewis and Whitmore, but Lewis left, so I had the organic. And they had Ward Evans, a charming personality, but not really a great physical chemist. But he was a raconteur par excellence. No, the institution was kind of weak in research.
You made an enormous difference.
Well, Whitmore did, really. He was the dynamic person that got things going here, and both applied after we came here for the American Petroleum Institute grant. That's the thing I almost got in error there before. But we were both able to have it. He worked on his Whitmore type of rearrangements, and actually that was entirely based on his experience with Jones. Whitmore's chemical theory taught at Harvard were nil. He was putting out these things, you know. He put a proton onto an alcohol and get an olefin out of it, and if you take the right one where there wasn't any hydrogen next door, the methyl group wandered. Well, I was at an ACS meeting where he actually gave that as a talk. At the close of the meeting, he was asked by somebody in the audience, you haven't used the word carbonium ion there, but aren't those carbonium ions that move? Oh, no, those aren't carbonium. He knew that Jones had a hydroxamic acid in which a radical moved, but he had taken an anion and lost an anion, which means there was no actual charge that was created or lost. But in Whitmore's case, he put a proton on a neutral compound, and he lost a neutral compound, so he had to have a plus charge, but he didn't know that. He just rationalized from Jones's type of rearrangement to his that they were both neutral.
How long did he stay at Northern?
He hadn't learned how to count electrons. Well, he actually soon learned.
How long did he stay at Northwestern?
Oh, from about for 10 years. The last 2 years he was here, though, he was primarily in Washington, D.C. as head of the National Research Council Division of Chemistry. But he actually appointed a committee of three of us, Hines, Evans, and Hurd, and he hadn't ever thought too much of Evans, and Hines hadn't ever published anything, so he had me be it sort of an executive or secretary on matters that had to be treated. We handled everything except the pocketbook. He came up here when he had to talk to the dean about money.
What did he do to convince you to move from Illinois? What was his selling point?
Well, as I recall it, I don't know if he telephoned or wrote a letter. I think he wrote a letter. And probably it was the higher rank and higher pay that persuaded me. I actually started out at Illinois at $1,800 a year. That would be small chicken feed today. Hiring anybody.
What did he give you here when you started at Northwestern?
I think I got 2,400.
That's a nice percentage increase.
Yeah.
And when you came here then, were you teaching primarily organic?
Yes, that's right. I had the elementary course and usually also an advanced course in the year.
What was Whitmore like to work for?
He was a hard worker, and he expected hard work of other people. From that point of view, he was easy to get along with. I think if you hadn't been an equally hard worker, though, he would have pushed you along into it, or at least their tribe to. We had some persons, though, that were not really, but they were older than he was.
At the time that you were starting to teach organic, and you just commented about Whitmore's not being able to count electrons.
Yeah.
But the whole Lewis concept was still pretty new at that point.
You mean G.N. Lewis?
G.N. Lewis, yes. I'm sorry, yes. G.N. Lewis.
Oh, that was brand new.
And
right.
So it...
Terms like leaving group had never been coined yet. And the octet theory of G.N. Lewis was really brand new.
Did you introduce that in your teaching?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember what text you used in your first, when you first started up here?
I think it was Norris.
Okay.
Or Perkin. I had Perkin and Kipping in college. You probably have never heard of it, but it was a British text and a good one.
Is that the Kipping of the silicone? There was a Kipping in England who was some early silicone.
I think so, yeah, yeah. But I think that I used the text by Norris, which really was terrible, their terminology. I recall at an ACS meeting once when F.B. Daines was chairman. He was a grand old fellow, really, from Kansas. And at the end of the business meeting, he said, "Are there any other comments?" And there wasn't any at all. After half a minute, I said, "Well, how would it be if we'd have a committee to study improvement of nomenclature?" Well, Daines was very sympathetic to that. Probably he'd had the same trouble with textbooks that needed some improvement. And he passed that idea on to Whitmore, who was the chairman then of the organic division. Well, Whitmore passed it on to me, so I became the chairman with a committee of one there to do something about nomenclature.
And that committee existed a long time, didn't it? That committee existed a long time.
Well, it certainly did, yeah.
How sympathetic were other organic chemists to your attempts to sort out nomenclature?
Well, I tell you, I started out by taking a whole lot of texts and journals, sort of thumbing the pages for words that were used for certain structures. And if they deviated from what I thought they ought to be, I put them in a list. And I had a list of about 100 names that I mailed to approximately 100 organic chemists that I thought well of. Asked them if they had any comments, good or bad. I was amazed at the almost uniformity of the fact that they said this is the type of thing that we ought to do. So, to answer your question, I kind of had them be a party to it. Found out what they thought, and they all thought this pretty well. I think most of them were pleased they didn't have to be on a committee.
Did organic textbooks change as a result of this? Did you make an influence on them, authors?
I didn't ever there study it from that point of view. I would study a text reasonably carefully if I thought I was going to adopt it. Mm-hmm. But after I was up here for a period, I didn't keep on teaching the elementary course too much.
I still have Alder's catalog number 3 corrected by you.
Number 3.
One and two were just one page circulars.
You had indicated to me earlier that Dr. Hurd would up until just recently was still correcting the nomenclature.
Oh, yes.
Well, actually,
it was a month ago that you were to be about the actor. Remember isonitriles?
You know, though, I think you have done more to do good nomenclature than you possibly think you are.
Well, we have
because
to
of your catalog you. And your good use of names in your bulletins that you publish.
You don't know how often I have said to our people, "Boy, what Charles Hurd would say to that, change it."
But Eastman Kodak isn't that careful.
Well, if I had $20 billion in Camelot sales, we wouldn't be either. It was Union Carbide that had lots of bad names.
Certainly was. That's right.
But why is that? I mean, I've taught some elementary organic to nursing students, and of course you deal with nomenclature.
That was the first course I taught here, and I came up in the summer session. I had a bunch of hospital nurses. They worked all night. I had them at 8 o'clock in the morning. They were half asleep. I had never talked such a curse in my life.
I was going to...
Did you also have that experience?
Yes. It's an interesting group of people to deal with, that's for sure. But there's an interesting relationship there with nomenclature, because many of those students don't see a need for studying chemistry. And yet nomenclature, in terms of the drugs and everything else that they have to deal with, I think is very important. And I always try to impress upon them this idea of how much you can get out of a name, and by looking at a name and understanding something about its the structure and also what it might do by the nomenclature. And I still to this day in a hospital, somebody wants to give me something, I make sure I read the label too and not just...
They make mistakes.
They make mistakes. And that was one of the things I was trying to tie to them, was this importance of nomenclature. And
well, would you call the word aspirin part of nomenclature? Or would it have to be the actual name that's also on the bottle?
Yes. No, I agree with it, that aspirin's not a nomenclature in that sense. But in this exchange you just had about people publishing things that are careless about nomenclature,
yeah,
to me,
yeah,
that was one of the fun parts of organic chemistry long ago when I was a student, and how important it is to be able to convey something through the right name.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have companies who aren't doing that aren't paying attention to what they're publishing, it can create difficulties, I would think, too. That's why I said you were struggling with nomenclature back in 1922 in your PhD thesis. You were...
Well, I had no help, so I had to do something.
Did you get to Europe at any time?
Hmm?
Did you travel to Europe at all?
Did I what?
Did you travel to Europe in those days?
Have I?
Yes.
I have never gone to Europe. What's over there?
Well, you know, a good many American chemists did go to study in Germany or England.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have the money to do that. I stayed home.
You were in this, I'm not clear on the dates, between assistant and associate professor. You started here as an assistant professor in 24. And
here, yes.
And then when did you get promoted to associate?
I think you're 28.
1928, okay.
Yeah.
It was the one date I didn't...
And I got to be a full professor, I think, about 32 or 33. And then about 1948 or 9, I became Morrison professor, that I could only keep 2 years. I was told I had to give it up.
Hmm.
For... I had the name, the title given in place of an increase in pay, and I kept to be Morrison professor.
That was a common tactic in academic institutions.
And 2 years afterwards, however, I was told to give it up, and I would become the Clare Hamilton Hall Research Professor of Organic Chemistry for a considerable increase in pay.